What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Okay, here we go with this week's episode of the Midweek Howl, the non-paranormal part of the From the Shadows podcast. And with me, as always, is the infamous and world-renowned Ozark Howler. How's it going today?
It's too early to tell.
It's too early to tell. It's
late. Usually we do this in the afternoon, and I've got a whole plate of good and bad. But now it's too early to tell.
Okay. Well, for all of our longtime regular listeners, you know, every once in a while we have a guest, and we have a very interesting and exciting, I think, guest. he's laughing like, oh God. I'm gonna use his own words, I think, to describe him. He is a pop culture writer and trash culture obsessive. So welcome to the Midweek Howl, Mr. Nathan Raven. How's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we dive into the deepest parts of what is Nathan Raven, I want to thank Jason Weber, who was a guest with me in the Howler not too long ago. You might remember he was Cardi Finkbeiner's right-hand man for a little bit, the mayor of Toledo, and closely associated with the Insane Clown Posse. So what I know of having done some research on Nathan, he, you know, just from that little blurb, he's obsessed with pop culture and what kind of, let's be honest, other than religion and politics, what really makes America run, what makes America run, despite Dunkin' Donuts making that claim. There's something going on right now before we dive into this that I think on one hand, the Howler will have a unique perspective on it. And Nathan, I think you'll have a unique perspective on this last weekend of all the quote unquote UFOs or unknown objects being shot down by the United States and the Canadian government. And even apparently China claims to have shot something down. So I want your take, Howler, on maybe a more government take on it, and then I would want your take on like you know, pop culture, you know what that whole UFO frenzy meant in the 40s and 50s and why it's not why it's a little bit different now, you know? So, Holler, what's your take on that?
You mean as far as these dim guys blasting away at these unidentified objects?
Yeah. Like, what do you think?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you. Hey, 10 years ago, if you were an infantry guy in Afghanistan, they'd put you in penitentiary for shooting unidentified objects, right? You have to be sure of your target and what's beyond it before you can engage in it. So I don't understand who's commanding these people just to go out there and shoot a bunch of shit down, but they probably need to stop. Okay. That's the first thing that comes to my brain. The second thing that comes to my head is, well, I'm not even going to say it. You know, I have such, you know, there's nothing wrong with the government. It's just the people in it is the problem, right? So I don't know, did they just all of a sudden pop up, you know, like mushrooms, these how come we didn't have them a month ago, right? And if we did, how come nobody knew about it, right? So,
I did read an article that said because of that weather balloon, they readjusted the radar to start checking out things at a lower altitude. And so now these things that would have normally escaped detection are now showing up. Or, you know, now they're quote unquote.
That could be. I just, you know, I told you about the wheelbarrow German story, didn't I?
The wheelbarrow German. No,
what, I told you that? The wheelbarrow German. Oh, I know. I told you the wheelbarrow
German
story, right? So the short version is this: in my previous life, I had to talk to a judge about a deal, and it didn't come. You know, we didn't know. He signed a search warrant that I needed, and we searched this guy's stuff, and it just didn't pan out, right? So. In the federal system, when you do a search warrant, you have to do what's called take the return back to the judge that signed it. Usually within it's by 10 days by statute, but usually you go, but for respect, if you get something really cool, you bring it in there the next day, right? Or if you don't get anything like me. So I walked in the magistrate's office the next day, and actually the judge's office, a full judge, not a magistrate, but. And the girls ushered me to the back. Normally, you just give it to the clerk, right? And they said, the judges wanting to know what was in that package because there was a whole bunch of stuff involved that was kind of cool, right? So I go in this palatial judge's chambers, and he said, what'd you find? And I said, well, nothing. He goes, we mean nothing. And I kind of tell him what was in these boxes that we had this search warrant for. And he says, well, you know, I was in Germany. He said, when I got out of law school, I joined the Army and was commissioned as a first lieutenant or second lieutenant or whatever. And the Army paid for my law school if I did 6 years. And he said, they sent me over to Germany to be a JAG lawyer. And that was at the height of the Cold War. And he said, our office was within walking distance of the Brandenburg Gate, where you could cross between East and West Germany. And he said there was a gentleman that would sometimes every week, sometimes a couple times a week, would cross through the Brandenburg Gate with a wheelbarrow load of dirt. And he said, we detained him. The East Germans detained him. The Russians detained him. We x-rayed the wheelbarrow. They x-rayed the wheelbarrow. We tested the dirt. They tested the dirt. And it wasn't until the fall of the wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union that we found out, you know, people found out, and a friend of mine called me and said, hey, you're never going to guess what the deal with the wheelbarrows was. He was smuggling wheelbarrows. So they were very cheap and easy to get on the American side. They were hard to get on the East German side. So he would start with, he'd just go get a brand new wheelbarrow full of dirt and push it through the gate, right? Then they never put it together. That he never had the wheelbarrow coming back. He always had it going over. So back to these UFOs. No matter what the greatest minds come up with, it won't be right, right? It'll be they're looking through a prism of their own education and experience and that sort of thing, background, if you will. And they're probably not going to be – they may be close, but they're probably not going to be right.
Okay.
And now it could be college students because knowing what you know now, you could go out here and fill up, you know, I don't know what you could get that. You know, my daughter asked me when the very first one they were talking about shooting down, remember? And yeah. I said something about China. And I said, you know, this those on 4th of July, that's the big thing to put those Chinese balloons. You know what I mean? You start the little fire and the thing and the
heat. Oh, yeah.
You know, the lantern. And I said, that's what it is. Yeah. And she said, are you serious? I said, yeah. I guess it came all the way from China and they're freaked out about it. I don't know. You know, but so now as a college kids, they want to do a prank. So they get an inflatable pool and fill it full of helium or whatever it takes, you know, at the local community college and let it go up there and say, screw the man. I don't know.
Right? Well, so Nathan, then I want to ask you, like I said, you're knee deep in pop culture. Like, so can you imagine this sort of stuff being talked about by the government in the 40s and 50s and the reaction by people then? Like, what do you think has changed over the years?
Well, I think we're a lot more skeptical. You know, I think there are a lot more places for people who are skeptical to congregate. And then just the blinkered way that my brain works is I relate everything to the songs of Weird Al Yankovic. Whom I am the world's preeminent expert. So I'm thinking of songs like The Attack of the Radioactive Hamsters from a Planet Near Mars, or a Foil, in which he explores this UFO phenomenon. I'd have to check in with him. What's really going on with weather balloons?
Those are deep cuts. I'm just going to
say. Well, the Attack of the Radioactive Hamster from a Planet in Mars, which I'm very proud of myself that I got that name correct. That is, in fact, a deep cut, but a Foil. That's actually one of his more recent bangers. That was a flat-out single. And, you know, that again, that kind of explored the whole conspiratorial mindset and how it has evolved with time and has evolved with the way that, you know, we communicate. And the internet, I think, has kind of set the whole thing aflame. There can just be more and more wild, wild, wild conjecture.
Yeah, that is true. We see that with the, you know, just some of the video, like some of the videos and stuff that come across from people, like this is evidence of this and this is, and you can't hardly even tell what's real and what's a really good fake anymore. I mean, it's so, crazy.
The whole idea of deep fakes to me is very, very, kind of fascinating, but also incredibly creepy and disturbing. Because it seems like with deepfakes, you can make anybody do anything. And I don't think that necessarily should be the case. You know, you shouldn't have Albert Einstein starring in a breakdancing movie. certain boundaries that should be respected. And just because you can have, you know, the CGI Albert Einstein, you know, and step up. Seven does not mean that you necessarily should have it. There's what's I think from Jurassic Park. Just because you can doesn't mean that you should.
Oh, I like that. I like that reference. I like that. So Nathan, tell us a little bit because you got some pretty impressive credentials, and you know, I it's not everybody that gets to be the head writer at The Onion. So. You know, can you kind of tell us how you got into all this stuff? And for the record, I'm probably a little bit older than you, I think, but I was a huge Weird Al fan back in the day. I was the guy that had, you know, his first couple albums and stuff. When the kids, when I went to school, were like, who is this guy? And then Edith gets on the radio and they're like, oh my God, you've been listening to this guy for years. And I don't know whether they thought I was weird or a genius, but you know, I'm not as big a Weird Al fan as you, because you have certainly made it a big part of your life. But man, I do appreciate everything he has done over the years. I think he's very underrated.
Yeah, well, I mean, I kind of feel like, I sort of grew up with Weird Al. The first album that I ever owned was, I think, Huey Lewis and the News Sports, and then I had an album called Thriller, by Michael Jackson. And like the third album that I ever owned was In 3D by Weird Al Yankovic. And I remember as a kid listening to Dr. Demento, and I was obsessed with the radio. I'd listen to Dr. Demento and the Funny Five, and then I listened to Casey Kasem and the Top 40. And I felt like those were kind of, you know, the two sides of a coin. You know, you had the mainstream and the popular and the stuff that everybody listened to, and then you had the crazy stuff that Dr. Demento wind up your radio. I remember the first concert that I ever went to was Weird Al Yankovic opening for the Monkees. And I was equally obsessed with both. This was 1986. So this was actually the second Monkees reunion tour. The first one was way more popular. That's one of the fun things about working on Weird Al Yankovic's coffee table book, Weird Al the book with him, is that I got to hear some of the gossip and some of the dish. So apparently that second time around, the Monkees weren't anywhere near as popular, so they kind of had to cut a lot of costs, which is not ideal when you're touring with somebody. But I remember going to that show and being blown away. And I could have left after Weird Al Yankovic and been happy. And I remember, talking to my dad. I mean, like, it's so incredible. Like, they can play any kind of music, and they have such showmanship and such theatricality. And I had no idea what a profound impact Weird Al would have on my life going forward. And then, when I went away to college, I hooked up with the AV Club, which was the entertainment side of the onion. And God, I have a very long, possibly boring and tedious story of how I got involved with the onion, but I'm going to tell it anyway. I apologize. Oh, I apologize preemptively. My older sister was friends with this guy, Mike Lowe, who is a graphic designer of The Onion, did amazing, amazing stuff. If you remember the headline, Christ Returns to the NBA of Jesus Slam Dunking, that was some of Mike Lowe's Photoshop magic. So my sister said to Mike Lowe, hey, my brother is really funny. He should write for The Onion. How does he do that? And he should have said, you know, F that. We don't need anybody else. Leave me alone. But my sister is very charming and appealing. So he said, hey, what you can do is you can send lists to the editor of The Onion. And if he'd like those lists, maybe he'll invite him to be part of like a meeting to hash out different headlines and assignments and whatnot. So I would send these lists to the Onion. And again, this was in 1986. So I would write them out on loose leaf paper with a pen, and then I would put it into an envelope, and then I would send that envelope to the editor's address. And it was crazy because like every week he would call me up and explain to me why all of my ideas were bad.
at least he took the time to call you up and tell you why they were bad.
Yeah, I mean, that was amazing. And again, I remember thinking at the time, like, part of me was, you know, I'm an insecure 20-year-old. Like, why are you being critical of me? And then the pragmatic, you know, appreciative part was thinking, this guy is a genius. He's giving me these lessons in comedy, and he's teaching me how comedy works. And he's like, even though I'm just this dumb shit who's going to Madison Area Technical College at the time, I hadn't even transferred over to Madison. But at the end of each time, he'd be like, but, you know, you have some promise, so keep on sending lists. So finally, I think I had three total headlines that made it into the Onion. I think one was Vincenzo Brothers give federal government 5 days to pay off national debt. I had one about the Vatican condemns whack MCs. And then U.S. to utilize Tony Danza-based curriculum. And that one ended up actually being weirdly prescient because Tony Danza actually has background as a school teacher. And he actually had a reality television show in which he, you know, tried to be a teacher in Philadelphia.
So the real question is, what would Ron DeSantis think of the Tony Danza curriculum?
That is a good question. he'd wonder who the boss was. That's the fun.
Oh, I like that.
Taxi subsidies for everybody.
Who really? who really was the boss? Did they ever really? Because I mean, somehow I know that was a subject of debate. Who really was the boss in that? Was it the kid, Tony Danza, the mom? I don't know.
Because I guess literally the mother would be the boss, in that she employed Tony Danza as a housekeeper. So she is the boss. But I think in a more metaphorical sense, maybe Tony Danza was the boss, or he thought he was the boss, but he found out that he wasn't the boss. It's been a long time since I've watched Who's the Boss. So it said in these things, then finally I had some in, and they said, well, why don't you come in and you can, you know, come to a meeting and we'll all talk about stuff. And yeah, I went to two meetings and I was terrified. And I was 20 years old, and everybody else was only 3 or 4 years older, but they seemed ancient and they seemed so accomplished and so impressive. And then I went to, you know, I would like read out my ideas and I would be so nervous that like you couldn't even understand them. And they weren't that good to begin with. And then my terrible delivery just made them worse. And then finally, we had, you know, like a meeting, and it was the final meeting of the old editor and like the first meeting of the new editor. And he was going to Los Angeles to make it in the business. And then I remember, God, I remember him giving the new editor a Vince Lombardi plaque, an inspirational Vince Lombardi plaque. And this was in Madison, Wisconsin. So it wasn't that ironic. He genuinely loves Vince Lombardi. And I remember him saying, you know, like, I know this is ironic, but like the Onion is, we have this incredible power and we're going to be like this national force and we're going to be a household name. Everybody's going to know who we are. And we're going to like have this profound impact on like the cultural discourse. And I remember looking at me like, you're out of your fucking mind. Like, you are so deluded. You think the Onion's going to be huge. Just like this dumb, you know, joke rag.
He didn't think it had that. Hey, he didn't think it had that potential, or what was he?
Yeah, I think I was just bitter because I knew that they didn't like my ideas and that I was on my way out. So I think I was just like, God, like, for you to like be so highfalutin, like, my goodness, like, you were just, ugh. And everything that he said turned out to be true. And everything that he said like came to fore. And then at the end of the meeting, he said, hey, Nathan, can you stick around? I want to talk to you afterwards. And I had a sense that he was not going to not going to offer me a staff position or anything. And I remember saying, you know, not really working out here. You got three main things going against you. One of which is you're too young. You're only 20 years old. Like, you're only a little younger than us, but, you know, there's like a crucial element that you're kind of missing. The second one of which is you don't really have a niche. There's not something that like you do better than anybody else. Third one, you're not that funny. I'm
like, that's what the guy told you?
Yeah. And he ended up, you know, we ended up being good friends, and you know, he was saying, he went to my wedding.
Did you remind him of that statement that you're not that funny?
I think he probably remembered it, you know, and I don't think he meant it, you know, overly critical or anything. And at that point, I was just grateful. I was just like, I'm just grateful because I'm out of place here. I don't belong here. I'm overwhelmed.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I was angry because I wasn't.
Back up. Now, he said something about you weren't that, or you did about your age, because he thought age, some kind of wealth of experience came with age.
Well, I think it's just that I was very green. I mean, I was literally 9 months out of living in a group home for emotionally disturbed adolescents.
If you want to get some background, to me, that sounds yeah. better than any J school you can go to, doesn't it?
It did. Well,
honestly.
That ended up being really good.
Can hire all kinds of English majors to edit, but who can you hire on the street that has been through an adolescent home like that?
Well, the problem with me is that I have a lot of personality and a lot of weird, interesting things about me, but I don't have any like grammar, or I don't have any professionalism, or any of the crap that people get when they go to J school and whatnot.
I doubt that. I mean, have you been around some of them?
I've been around a fair amount. So he said, like, yeah, you're no longer welcome. He said, but you can, like, why don't you, like, do some movie reviews? Those AV Club guys seem to need all the help they can get. And it was true because, like, the entertainment section at that point consisted of the editor coming into the writers, the comedy writers' room, and being like, who wants to review this crappy movie for $5? And they literally got paid $5. You would get reimbursed for the price of your ticket, and you would get paid $5. And I remember the first movie that I ever wrote about, the ticket was $7. And then I did get reimbursed. So I actually ended up losing $2 for my first review for the, and yeah, it's, now he's the head of music for NPR. He's gone on to be very, very successful. He's host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. But I'm like, yeah, those guys sure seem to need a lot of help. I'll call him up or I'll contact him. And then I never did that because I was just too shy or too nervous or too overwhelmed. And then I ended up working at a video store with the guy who ended up being the assistant editor of the AV Club. And I started, I said, hey, after about 9 months of working together, I said, hey, can I like write a movie review for you? And he's like, sure. Like, we've actually been talking about this. And I remember the first two that I ever wrote about were Romeo and Juliet, which was Troma's version of Romeo and Juliet, written by a young maverick of the silver screen named James Gunn. That was her big thing. And then it would be called Seconds. And then the comedy writers were writing Artem Century. So they did not have time to write movie reviews. So I wrote movie reviews. That's kind of how I ended up getting involved. And then, yeah, when I graduated from college, I became a staff writer and the internet was exploding and everything was good and the world radiated infinite promise. And yeah, I had no idea how fucked I was or how everything was going straight downhill.
So James Gunn wrote, what was, okay,
Romeo and Juliet, yes.
Romeo and Juliet. I'm trying to remember that movie. Because I also worked at a video store back at probably, I mean, you're talking the 90s, right? The
late 90s. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was from 1990 to 96. I worked at a video store.
So I worked a little bit after.
92 to 96, yeah.
I worked a little bit after that, and I'm trying to, Romeo and Juliet. Oh my gosh, I'm looking at it right now.
Definitely, if I remember correctly, there's a scene involving a mutant lactating cow.
A mutant lactating cow?
Yeah, which I don't think was in the original Shakespeare. I think that may have been a Romeo edition there. So yeah, and then I worked for the AV Club for about 12 years, and I got a direct message from Weird Al Yankovic. Asking me if I would be interested in writing his book. And I remember very vividly jumping up and down with my wife, my now wife, and saying, oh my God, we're going to be rich. We're going to be rich. Spoiler, I did not get rich, but I did get to write his book. And I led to writing several more books and writing several coloring books about Weird Al Yankovic. So yeah, it's been a wild ride. I've been doing this for 26 years.
So how big of a thrill was that then? And to find out that Weird Al was essentially a fan of yours.
It was incredible. And I think I mentioned him like in the acknowledgments for my first book, The Big Rewind, which was published in 2009, where I even might have spoken about how he had a really indelible impact on my sense of humor. And I feel like for a lot of smartasses, you kind of have this, you know, where you're a kid and you find Mad Magazine and you find Weird Al Yankovic and they kind of hit you to how the world really works. And the fact that adults are liars and, you know, capitalism the whole commercials exist to sell you things you don't need so that horrible people can have more money. Weird Al, I remember, the song Yoda. That making a really impact on me. And one of the lines in it is the long-term contract that I had to sign said I'll be playing this part until the end of time with my Yoda. And I remember thinking, like, that is so, like, I never thought about that before. you know, that these actors have to play these roles. They're locked into it. And, you know, you see it as this story and this adventure and, you know, that your childhood is based upon. And it's a business, you know. And it's fascinating, too, that this was written in 1981, 1982, because he couldn't get the rights to use it initially. And you look at it now and Carrie Fisher is playing Princess Leia even after she died.
Yeah, true.
That is amazing. And he anticipated all of that. He predicted, you know, and at the moment, like, it wasn't that unusual to be like, oh, they make sequels to popular movies. But I don't think people realize just how crazy it would be. I mean, like, there's also Ode to a Superhero, his Spider-Man song. And he talks about, you know, the sequel, the inevitable sequel to the 1997-98 Spider-Man. And not only did they make a sequel to that, but they made a sequel to that sequel. And then they rebooted the whole thing. And then they made a sequel to the reboot. And then they rebooted it a third time. And then they made a sequel to the reboot. And then they made a multiverse second sequel that's also a sequel to the Spider-Man 3 and the Amazing Spider-Man 2, because it involves, anyway, it's all very complicated. And my point is that Weird Al predicted it all. The Simpsons and The Onion and Weird Al predicted it all. And I think also, you know, 46 years old like I am, those are also kind of the cornerstones of your sensibility, and, you know, kind of showed you how the world works and how to see the world when you're at a young and suggestible age.
Well, I want to point out one thing from Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
Do you remember who the narrator was of that movie?
Lemmy from Motorhead.
Yes, Lemmy. Yeah. Motorhead. Lemmy from Motorhead. That's fantastic. Yeah. So I
don't remember anything that my wife tells me, but for some reason I remember that Lemmy from Motorhead was the narrator for.
It's fantastic. I mean, look, it's fantastic because Howard and I got some great fans over in Europe, and I know that Howard, would you agree? Stephen Waite has to be a Motorhead.
Yeah, I would think. I mean, yes. I mean, I would think. Yeah. Certainly, if not, maybe he's just playing the part, right? We all have to play the part.
So, and I wanted to ask you this, Holler, because of where you grew up. Now, I did not have access to Dr. Demento here where I grew up in Ohio. So I did not even discover Dr. Demento till actually a guy I worked with made a bunch of CDs for me off of the computer to where I could listen to a bunch of old Dr. Demento programs. Did you guys have him access
no,
to him?
I never heard of Dr. Demento till just right now. This is today. I was today's old. I was trying to think, was it a James Bond show that I didn't see? Or was it a spoof? Remember how those In Like Flint movies? You know who I'm talking about, James?
Yeah, James Coburn.
James Covert had almost a little spinoff of 007. That's what I was trying to figure out, if it was something like that. No,
That's weird. That's weird that, like, because I think Dr. Demento had to be in Detroit and places like that. Detroit.
We were still in the throes in the 80s. We were still in the throes of the Beverly Hillbillies rerun. Hee-haw on Saturday. You know, my big brother was just a crazy mad magazine guy, right? Him and his little crew. And I just remember people would look at that. When I say people our age, you know, like middle school to high school, and think, like, what kind of freaking planet are you guys on? And in some ways they thought completely different from their environment, right? Especially at that time where I grew up, because where I grew up, it was 95% German Catholics, right? Get your head down, go to work, go to church, keep your mouth shut, and pay your bills. That's all that you were expected to do your entire life, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
not thumb your nose at authority and
absolutely. So reading those Spy versus Spy or some stuff like that. I loved it when I was a kid. I loved it, you know, but everybody, you know, not everybody, but they should, you know, I keep reading where, and this dovetails in with your, your trashy culture, you know, where the it's a fatherless families creating all these weird problems in America. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I'm not for sure big brotherless family, and not necessarily a true biological brother, but the kids nowadays, not the, the boy kids, you know, if you're a senior in high school, you don't necessarily foster that nurturing of the younger ones. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
If somebody didn't do that for you, you don't turn around and kind of, you know, if you're the senior in high school and are you teaching the freshmen and sophomores, you know, how to make that next step in their manhood.
Certain days I can remember, you know, 1984 when Van Halen's 1984. I mean, I remember my big brother and his buddies, you know, with they weren't real Stratocasters, they were knockoffs, trying to be Eddie Van Halen, you know, and in the midst of a place that was so far. Now, Shane, it's fairly close. It's closer to where you grew up than Chicago. You know, that there was people out there that I don't want to say thought differently, because you could think differently all you wanted, you, as long as you shut your mouth and didn't talk. Does that make sense? You
can think
all you want, but you do not act on those impulses.
Because
we will shame you.
Yeah, exactly. Like Nathan, like just the idea that you, and I guess we never did ask, like, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Kansas City, Missouri. And then I grew up in Chicago, partially outside of Milwaukee. I remember, I think just over the course of my life, geography has become a lot less important. You know, because with the internet, you can connect with anybody anywhere, and you can have these sort of two lives. And one of your lives is, you know, in Alpharetta, Georgia, where I live right now, and the other one is on the internet. And I'm not sure that one is necessarily more important than another. And then, actually, speaking of that, you know, so we talked about Dr. DeVento. You know, I guess now he's basically on the internet. And that is nice, and that, you know, it's available for everyone, but it's, you know, something is kind of lost. Like, there's something special, you know, about, I guess, kind of the
I know what you're saying is you knew when you were listening to Dr. Tomento that not everybody got to listen to him, and it kind of held like a romantic spot in your heart, because it's and to go back to like the Weird Al, I knew, like, where I was from, having that first album, you know, and that not everybody had heard Mr. Frump and his Iron Lung. Okay. You know what I'm saying? And then as a kid, I'm like, this is genius. I love this irrelevant sense of humor. And it's like, I knew, though, that I was probably the only person in the county listening to that. We lived so far out in the middle of nowhere. Like, I think the Howlers talking about that.
Right.
I could be a big fan of that and dream about how cool it would be like Weird Al, but we didn't have any outlet for that, because if you just said, God, I want to be a writer, I want to write, you know, songs like that, they've been like, well, just go get your gun and let's work on the car. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yes. Yes.
Oh, totally.
So I think, like, you know, it is important, you know, whether you're that big brother teaching the kid, the people following you, hey, let's go get your gun and go hunting, or yeah, you can play guitar, or you can write for a living, or you can, you know, whatever. I think you need that kind of inspiration, and that's today you can get that inspiration. Like, you know, I've talked to people in Nashville all the time and work with artists and songwriters and stuff. And that's something I would never have been able to do 30 years ago, you know? And so it does help get that creative side out. So I'm definitely envious of people that got to experience that at a younger age, you know, not that it would have been any better for me.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, you find your people and you find the things that really speak to you. And it's a lot easier to do now that you have the internet. And, you know, Weird Al, last year, they put out his biopic, his Peronic biopic. Yeah. And it's, I love that movie. I've seen it several times. I wrote a special essay for it, for the 516-page latest version of my epic book about Weird Al's complete life's work, The Weird Accordion to Al. And there are scenes in there where he is, you know, sending off his home demo off to Dr. Demento. And it's literally, you know, you record it on a tape or on 8 tracks, and then you put it in the mail, and then somebody plays it on the stereo. And there's something so nostalgically satisfying about that, about how primitive it is. And it reminds me of me, like when I was sending stuff in for The Onion. And, you know, my God, the career that he has carved for himself did not exist when he was 16 years old. And the thing that's amazing about Weird Al is it's never existed for anybody other than him. You know, nobody yeah. else in the world has a career. Weird Al, you're sort of talking to about the stuff that's popular and stuff that's, you know, more obscure. One of the sort of tropes and conventions of Weird Al's albums is that the first song is the single, and the first song is the parody, and the first song is the hit, and the first song is the song they really want people to hear and they think has a very good shot of being successful, and then the last song is completely insane.
It's always
it's like 12 minutes long, or it's like a Frank
Zappa. Polka. Isn't it like a polka song?
Well, I think the first one was there, but Mr. Frump and the Outlong, it's like the first one is for, you know, everybody, and then the last one is the one that gets your mind to be like, why are you listening to this, and what is wrong with this man? So I feel like we, the culture, have come to appreciate the final song and everything that it represents a lot more. When I started working for Al in 2011, I felt like sort of my job was to make a case for him as an important artist, as a satirist, as this, you know, sort of national treasure, and I felt like I did a pretty okay job with that in Weird Al the book. But then he himself has made that argument a lot more, and, you know, he hasn't put an album in 9 years, which is kind of crazy when you think about that. But he's more respected and popular probably than ever before, and part of that is, you know, that he can build on everything that he's done before through things like, you know, his movie, which is, you know, a meditation on his career, and has re-recorded versions of a lot of his hits, where, yeah, he's sort of taking something old and making it new, and taking something new and investing it with the old.
Well, I will say this, that number one, every year at Christmas at my day job as a mailman, the guy next to me always plays Christmas songs, and I always remind him, hey, you need to play Christmas at Ground Zero. And so at least once a year I get to hear Christmas at Ground Zero. And I encourage everybody that has never heard that song to go look it up right now and listen to it.
Well, it's just like the way the world has worked is so fascinating to me, because that is a pastiche of Phil Spector, the Phil Spector Christmas album.
Yeah, exactly.
And the time since he recorded that, Phil Spector murdered somebody.
Allegedly. Yeah, he still claims he's innocent, doesn't he?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what Phil Spector has claimed a lot of things over the years.
He died of COVID in prison, I believe, right?
You know, I think he did. I know he got his hair cut in prison.
Because Robert Blake, I think, is still running around committing crimes.
Are you trying to say Robert Blake killed Phil Spector in prison? Is that
Yeah, that is a conspiracy theory. I did, you know, I watch Pluto, you know, a lot, and I watched Carson interview. I watched a lot of Carson's, crazy as that sound. And he had Robert Blake on there. And I guess, first of all, I didn't realize Robert Blake was a real star at one point.
Oh, yeah.
And second of all, he was kind of an oddball back in his heyday of the Beretta days. He came across kind of,
you're right. I guess oddball would be a good assessment.
Well, a little man, you know, I could totally see he had little man syndrome. And anyway, yes, you're right. Phil passed from us January 16th, 2021. And I didn't realize, until, I don't know if it was Cocaine and Rhinestones, or maybe it's Marin when I listen to the podcast, that Phil Spector did a hell of a lot of stuff. I mean, he produced a lot of stuff.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So does the money turn him odd, or are they odd to begin with?
I think he was always nuts. You know, I think he was always kind of bonkers. And he had, you know, sort of both Robert Blake Phil Spector had very traumatic childhoods, and they, you know, sort of became very successful very young. And I think their brains weren't able to, you know, sort of handle that level of success, particularly with, you know, their level of mental illness and, you know, awful relationship with their parents. And
$1 million and they don't know how to, it short circuits them.
Oh, for sure, man. And yeah, you look at like Robert Blake's last, just memorable performance was in Lost Highway, the David Lynch movie where he's so unbelievably creepy. And yeah, I think that's him and Richard Pryor's final film. So yeah, two
icons. I have never seen Lost Highway.
Oh my God, it's so good, and his part is so disturbing and iconic. You know,
wasn't
like all
he? Didn't he play in what was the Kansas killer movie?
Cold Blood.
Was he in that?
Yeah. That was one of his sort of star making turns. And again, he very convincingly played a murderer in that. So yeah, it's just interesting to think about. You know, that was theoretically innocent and whimsical and all American. You look back at it now and you're like, that man that was insane and also a murderer.
Well, that brings me to something. When I was doing some research on you, and I went to, I don't want this to sound weird, but I went to Nathan Robbins' Happy Place.
I want people to go there.
Which I encourage everybody to go to Nathan Robbins' Raven's Happy Place. Yes, is that you did a review of the movie Ghost Dad? Holly, do you remember Ghost Dad? Who the star of Ghost Dad was?
I don't even know what was that about. When did it come out?
I'm gonna say 92 or 93.
I think 89. I think I was still in the 90s.
Oh, it was 89. It was still 89. Was a Bill Cosby vehicle in which he played the dad who died and came back to terrorize, right? As a ghost. And I remember going to the theater to see that and being so disappointed because it was not funny. It was right on par with JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling, the Richard Pryor movie that I went to see in high school that I thought, oh, it's going to be funny. It's Richard Pryor. It was terrible. I
mean, wait a second. Now, you tell me Pryor was in a movie and he wasn't funny?
I do not remember.
Well, he directed it. He co-wrote the screenplay and he directed it, I think, with Paul Mooney, and it was autobiographical. So I remember it being, pretty, it involved like sort of his childhood when he grew up in a horror house in Peoria, Illinois. But a lot of trauma there.
Paul Mooney was a co-writer on that. So two funniest dudes of the 60s, 70s, and 80s wrote a screenplay that has no humor in it. I find that's
terrible. No, I think the idea was that it's, you know, sort of prove himself as a dramatic actor. which, again, I think, you know, he was an incredibly talented guy. He could do anything if he wanted to. But it's funny they mentioned that, because Ghost Dad and being dramatic, because I also wrote about Fat Albert, which was Bill Cosby.
Oh, yeah.
The thing that's really fascinating to me about Fat Albert, other than they made a live action of Albert movie in 2004, is that it's incredibly depressing, and that it begins with the heroine being sad about her grandfather dying, and that it ends with Bill Cosby and who you're led to believe are the inspirations for the Cosby kids, literally all trudging down to the cemetery to go pay their respects to the guy who inspired the character Fat Albert. So, and like, literally, there's like a half hour of literally just like, this is just about death and Bill Cosby being sad that he's old. So it's a lot of his friends are dead.
But
and this somehow made it. Somebody's like, yeah, the fact that this is incredibly depressing, it's just about like mortality and aging. Like, yeah, it's just very,
now,
very confusing.
Now, hold on a second. Now, do you think that because you're probably, and I'm going to tiptoe around this, because I have this problem sometimes, because I don't want to talk down to the general public because my audience makes up some of the general public. But some people aren't that smart to see the layers of a screenplay or a movie. So, you know what I mean? So maybe they don't see it because you're smarter than they are, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, the phrase funereal would describe this. Because again, it's just like you theoretically want people to laugh and enjoy your movie based on a cartoon from the 1970s. You don't want them to be like, wow, death.
Hey, you know what? I love the music. We had that because that's when my daughters were, you know, fairly young. And it has some great music in there. I mean, my girls loved watching that movie, and I enjoyed the music. You know?
Well, and that's the thing is they literally do the theme song three different times. They're like, what do people like from this? They like the theme song. Let's do it. Let's do it again. Let's do it a third time. And it's like, well, it's certainly more popular than Bill Cosby coming to terms with his impending death.
Hasn't happened. He's went through some stuff and he's still clicking, you know.
And he's planning on doing a stand-up tour.
Now listen, Nathan, I'm just going to tell you this, because the only time I got to see Weird Al in concert, you know, guess who opened for him? Jeff Foxworthy.
Really? Oh, wow.
So now, if you're telling me Bill Cosby's going to make a comeback, I think Weird Al needs to go out and have Bill Cosby open for him. Like, there's got to be some kind of like the ironic tour, right? Wouldn't that be called?
Yeah, I would not want to support Bill Cosby in any of his endeavors. Beyond like crawling into a hole somewhere and dying.
And just tell him he's. No, I'm not going to say it. I was going to say something shitty, and I won't. Daughter might listen to this, but I was going to say, women tickets half price, or what could you give the poor guy? I don't know, but you know, it goes back to your trashy world we're in.
Yeah.
People will buy it. People are going to, I mean, he's going to sell out, right?
But Bill Cosby drinks on the tour 2023.
I'm telling you, man, people will buy it, and people buy the tickets. And
can we copyright that right now? Start selling t-shirts. Mm-hmm. Bill Cosby.
You certainly can.
Oh, you'll laugh so hard you won't remember a thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Oh,
that maybe we. Yeah, so that's one of the things that and the expanded version of my most recent book, The Joy of Trash, is I try and write about a lot of people and things that are terrible. And they're terrible from a moral standpoint, as well as a entertainment standpoint. So, like, one of the things that I write about is a coffee table book, devoted to Joe Camel.
Oh my God, I couldn't.
Did you say Joe Camel?
I got some of that. I think Jason sent me some stuff to read, and I started reading, and I'm like, oh my God, how do I not remember this?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Do you remember Joe Camel? Joe Camel was huge.
Oh, yeah. Camel Buck. Used to collect Camel. Now, I never smoked or anything, but back in my college days, one of the guys that's been on here a bunch, one of my best friends, his family owned a garbage business. And we'd stand on the back of the garbage truck in the summers and between on college breaks, and we would snag Marlboro Miles and Camel Bucks. And you'd send them in, and you'd get all this free stuff. Unfortunately, it was all advertising Marlboro and Camel, and none of us smoked, but you could get all this kind of cool stuff. But so, yeah, I remember Joe Camel.
Oh, yeah. And again, just the idea that people would be so proud of it that they would do like a victory lap. They said, because apparently they did like a congressional hearing, and they found out that more children recognized Joe Camel than did Mickey Mouse. So Joe Camel was more famous to children than Mickey Mouse was.
Oh,
now,
God.
Part of that could be the areas that they're polling those kids to, correct?
that is possible. And also, they polled kids who had sent in Camel Cash. So that was not the most objective demographic there.
Well, they should have had Mickey money then.
That's right. Well, you know, I've got my own Joe Camel stories, and I tell them to my kids all the time.
What Joe Camel?
Yeah, we would like to hear your Joe Camel
story. When I was a kid, it doesn't mean anything because you all don't know the city, but my grandmother lived over on West Main in Jefferson City, the state capital, and she used to give me or my brother, I remember when a carton of cigarettes was $10, and then it got up to, I think the last time I rode my bike to get one, it was $16 or $18 a carton. I would ride my bike down because my grandma was born in 1919 and never drove. And I would ride my bicycle. She'd give me a $20 bill. I'd ride my bicycle down to Convenient Food Mart. And if you're from here, you'd know where that's at. But anyway, walk in and she would let me buy like, Pepsi or grape soda was a thing back in them days or whatever. Let me buy some junk food with the change and get her a carton of Marlboro. So when I was 12, 13, 14, I was buying a carton of Camels to bring back to my grandmother who went to her grave smoking Camels with no filters, blaming cancer on the filter.
Because it was made out of plasters.
I don't know, but she blamed the filter. And she lived to be 85.
Wow. Did you have a note from her saying that you were allowed to buy? Because,
you know, I think I used a note once or twice, but not. But that's it, man. Because I guess they thought, man, if you're a kid, what other kid? First of all, I don't think it was illegal back then, was it? When they put the age limit on cigarettes.
Hey, look, all I know is I worked at a drive-thru right out of high school for a little bit, and we had this girl come in and with a note, like, I mean, I was just like, are you kidding me? You're like 12 buying, like, and the owner Pudge comes out and he goes, oh, that's okay, she's got a note from her mom. And I'm like, what? I go, Pudge, I've seen her, she's smoking out on the side. He goes, well, she's got a note. So you'd have to sell her cigarettes, and she'd walk right out the door and light up a cigarette.
Like she wasn't writing the note herself.
Yeah. But she had to look at it like, I'm just glad that somebody in that family can write a note.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So what do you think? Yeah. Is it going to get worse, Nathan?
I feel like the general direction of the world is just get worse and worse and worse. I feel like we're heading into apocalyptic.
What's the end look like?
I don't know. I feel like just over the course of my lifetime, I feel like life has gotten substantially worse. I feel like life gets better and worse at the same time. You know, it's kind of like technology.
like, I think we're all so incredibly grateful that technology has advanced so much, yet we're also so incredibly bitter and resentful and angry that it's advanced so much. And you look back sometimes, I don't know, like the 1980s, and, you know, you didn't have cell phones. And it's crazy, too, that that is such a thing that people sort of fetishize, sort of the lack of cell phones. Because they really are a miraculous device. The problem is that they're too miraculous, you know, they're too good, and that they make the rest of the world outside of the computer seem less shiny and less addictive and less exciting by comparison.
Which is the reason why kids don't read books anymore.
Yeah, ostensibly so, you know.
Now
it should be easier to read books and easier to find music, you know. And but again, too, that's, you know, it's less special if you don't have to do the work, you know. And I think one of the things that made, you know, in 3D, the Weird Al Yankovic album special, was you had to buy it for $14, and then you had to put it on your LP, and then you had to listen to it. And you know, whereas now you can just, you know, download something. And you add it to your 14,000 songs in your iTunes catalog, and those 14,000 songs mean less to you than the 10 albums that you had when you were a kid.
I think you're 100% right on that. That music is really taken for granted these days by the people consuming it, because there's so much new music that comes out every week. It's like Spotify on Spotify and SoundCloud, and that there's something like 40,000 new songs every.
Oh, come on, who's putting them all out?
It's all over the world. I kid you not. Wait, our buddy Wade looked that up. It's like, and that's maybe a day gets downloaded to the internet. Now, it doesn't mean that it's something anybody will ever hear. But yeah, I mean, because I work with a lot of young artists, and if they get 1,000 streams in the first weekend, they're pretty excited because it's all independent. And the equivalent of that would have been back. Now, there's no money in that 1,000 streams, but the equivalent of that would have been, you know, getting played on the radio back in the day 1,000 times, or selling 1,000 singles or something, you know. I mean, and that would have been a big deal back in the day. I mean, there's a lot of artists that would have, you know, liked to have that the first day if they were independent and nobody knew who they were, you know. So it doesn't I'm right there with you. I don't think it means as much because you don't have to physically, you know, maybe then go and turn the record over when it's, I mean, you don't even have to turn the tape over, you know, at least even cassette tapes you had to turn over to play the second side, you know, but it certainly is different. But I mean, I will tell you, and I think the whole, I think Weird Al is certainly underappreciated by,
you bet,
the mainstream, because as a songwriter, I know how hard it is to write a good song about anything. Okay. And I'm not even going to claim I've ever written a good song, but to sit there and take a song and write about something, you know, like eating food or just anything, and turn it into something that is engaging and fun and smart. I mean, I think that's more difficult than it is just to write the original song, you know. But I do think everybody can relate to, because everybody, I don't think there's anybody that hasn't changed the lyric in a song to be funny as they're driving down the road.
Hey, singing. I heard Michael Jackson was a big Al fan. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. He was a very, very big fan of his, you know. And there are sorts of legendary things like, Weird Al was comeback hungry, you know. I think he just come off of UHF. Yeah, I think UHF was it obviously now considered a masterpiece and a girl classic, but it was not a success at the time of its release. So he was going to return to a familiar source of inspiration. And he was going to parody Black or White, A Snack All Night. And he called up Michael Jackson and said, "Hey, Michael Jackson, you know, I've got this wonderful idea. Here are the lyrics, blah, 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 blah." And Michael Jackson said, "Yeah, you know, that maybe isn't the greatest idea. Like, maybe you're returning to the well of food-based parodies of my song too often. Like, why don't you, you know, maybe do something else?" So in desperation, he went and parodied a song called Smells Like Teen Spirit. And so indirectly, Michael Jackson being like, "No, that's not a good idea for a song. That sounds a little hack," is responsible for him releasing, you know, what was his huge comeback song and using him to a whole new generation. Sort of in a similar way, James Blunt's label said, "No, you can't parody You're Beautiful as You're Pitiful. Like, that somehow will lead to James Blunt being less respected and less popular." And God knows it destroyed Michael Jackson and Madonna's careers when Weird Al parodied one of their songs. "We're going to say no. No to you, Weird Al Yankovic." So he's like, "Crap, I need a song that was going to be my single, blah, blah, blah. What will I do? Oh, there's a song, Writing Dirty. And I can do that as White and Nerdy." And so he kind of threw that together at the last minute. And that is his biggest hit. His, his very biggest hit. So yeah, sometimes when life closes a door, it opens a window.
It's hard to believe that White and Nerdy was a bigger hit than Eat It.
Yeah. It was right up there. And you know, Mandatory Fun was his only album to debut at number one, and that was in 2014. So 31 years into his career as a recording artist, yeah, I think about it, like, he may never release another album. Like, the industry has just changed in a lot of ways. And also, if he were to put another album, in order for it to have the same sort of constitution before, it would have to be half parodies and half parodies of very big contemporary hits. And Al will be 64 years old.
I'm gonna throw it out there, Nathan. Yeah. Since you have a direct pipeline, mm-hmm. If Weird Al wants to do a country album, and he wants to parody some great country songs, I'm all in.
Yeah.
If he needs a co-writer, I'm all in. I got a little experience in the country bar. I'm all in. I'll volunteer my services for at least one song, because that would be much like you getting to write his biography. That would be the right up there.
Right. You know what I think he should do? Instead of parodying that song, he should parody news. Parody, you know, news. So we could have Balloon Day, and we could have, you know, would mean different. Yeah, I think he should be parodying news stories.
You mean listen, we don't need his competition with the podcast. I mean, come on. Well, I think we could go on all day long, because there's just this the pop culture is a endless well of inspiration, I think, or desperation, however you want to look at it. But Nathan, I want you to tell everybody that was listening, that listens to this, where they can find Nathan Raben's Happy Place and check out some of these some of the books and stuff that you've written.
My website is Nathan Raben's Happy Place. It's my name, NathanRaben.com. And then I have a book coming out in March, the extended version of The Joy of Trash. And then I've written a bunch of books about Weird Al Yankovic that you can buy. I encourage you to buy them from the store at my website. That's, you know, the shop that you can find. And then I've got a podcast called Travolta Cage, where me and my co-host watch and talk about all of Nicolas Cage and John Travolta's movies in order. And that's a lot of fun. And we're very, very deep into that. And then I just started a new Substack called Nathan Raben's Bad Ideas, where I write about new movies, and I write about all of Ernest P. Worrell's filmography, and I'm about to write about all of James Belushi's movies. Why? I don't know. It's a bad idea. So those are the places where you can find me.
Now, Nathan, to add to your list, I know you probably have never heard of Escape from Death Block 13, but if you ever get to that movie,
yes,
I'd love to see the review on that. And then go down the whole, the guy that was in the movie with me, Robert Bronzy, who looks just like Charles Bronson.
Oh, yeah.
And go down all his movies that some of these producers with designed intentions put him in these movies because he looks just like Charles Bronson. And that's a whole nother, that could be a whole nother.
Like, yeah, that sounds like a bad idea for me. You want for me to pursue. So
it is. Yeah, go watch Death Kiss. That is a really bad idea. Awesome. But Bronzy's a fantastic guy. And that's just a shame that, you know, these guys tried to exploit it. But Escape from Death Block 13 is a fantastic movie. I know the Howler, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, I back to Pluto, right? You wouldn't want to catch Bronson movies, get your Pluto app going.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. You know, it would have made it. I don't want to take anything away from Bronzy. If Bronson would have made it, I think it could have been a real Bronson movie.
And the bad thing was, is I had on my list to talk about Travolta Cage. So I'm just going to encourage everybody
to go check.
That is a fantastic idea. I can't wait to go check that out and listen to it.
That's a lot of fun. We had a lot of really great guests too. So
I love it. Well, Nathan, I am thankful that Jason recommended you coming on, and I hope everybody enjoyed all of our nonsense, because it was a great discussion on some.
Oh, definitely. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I'm super jealous because I too am a huge Weird Al fan, and I respect all his work, and in fact I'm going to be ordering one of those coffee table books. So
awesome.
I think it looked right here good on my coffee table where I'm sitting. so well, Nathan, thank you so much. And
you bet. Yep.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, man. It's been fun.
Thanks, man. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Right. Awesome. Okay, goodbye, guys.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of the From the Shadows podcast. Until next time, never shy away from the darkness or what may be lurking in the shadows. We are out.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.